Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do they really know? Every week, me, Jason Carty,
and me, Stephen Cockcroft, the Beatle Brains of Ireland, go here, there and everywhere, taking a forensic deep dive into the story of the greatest band of all time, the Beatles.
Come with us every week on a magical mystery tour as we talk albums, singles, solo careers, books, films, and so much more.
Become a member of Nothing Is Real on Acast Plus today for ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more, because happiness is a warm podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. John Lennon first met Paul McCartney in 1957, and the Beatles actively released music between 1962 to 1970. So when you look at Beatle history, which year has had the greatest impact on the group? And today we're going to look at 1980. We think that is the year that had the greatest impact on how we understand the Beatles today. It has everything to do with 1980. And, you know, I think broadly speaking, you know, to be a Beatles fan in 1979 versus being a Beatles fan in 1981, they are two totally different situations.
Absolutely. I think everything fundamentally changed in 1980 in terms of just where the Beatles were culturally and how the public reacted to them, related to them.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to have a little recap first of the where we stand, the state of affairs in 1979, and then we'll kind of walk through 1980 and look at what everybody was doing at that time. So to recap, at the end of the 70s, you know, let's start with Ringo, because in the late 70s, it wasn't really a good time for Ringo. You know, he'd his musical career, he was initially the most successful Beatle, wasn't he, in the charts, but he was now at a low point.
Yeah, he'd straight out of the traps, post-split, he was outselling Lennon, he was outselling McCartney in terms of singles. He had 8 top 10 hits, 2 number one singles. You know, Lennon at one point was joking with Ringo, perhaps you could write me a hit.
And so he'd played Ringo the Fourth in 1977. That had been a big flop. He switched from Atlantic Records to a CBS subsidiary. He put out the Bad Boy album. That was another flop. It only got to 129.
Terrible record.
I have to admit, I've never listened to Bad Boy. Do I need to?
No, I know we like to send people back to the records, but that's not a destination anyone need visit.
And, you know, it failed to hit the charts in the UK. It only got to 129 in the US. And, you know, it's the 70s was an interesting period. The Beatles had been synonymous with success, and now we're kind of getting to see the reality of the situation. And then by 1979, Ringo had actually become quite unwell. In April 79, he went into hospital in Monte Carlo for a surgical procedure on his intestines, which was very serious, apparently. And that's based on a lifetime of medical illnesses.
Yeah.
However, a few weeks later, he did manage to reach one of the kind of highlights in 1979, which was Eric Clapton's wedding.
Yes, so this is one of those sort of legendary almost reunions. So this was Eric Clapton marrying Patti Boyd, who had been George Harrison's first wife. And he had a band, as you would if you were Eric Clapton. And the invites to the wedding went out to Paul, to George, to Ringo. Not to John.
No.
And there's a little bit of confusion as to why that was the case. Eric says he just forgot.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just Lennon had been off the scene for a while by that stage, wasn't really...
He was in a different country. He was in a different headspace, you know.
But Lennon did say afterwards if he'd been invited, he would have come. But that so at that wedding, the wedding band at one point included Paul, George and Ringo.
Ringo. And so if John had been there, what could have been? And there's some very charming photos of that day with Paul, George and Ringo with Lonnie Donegan.
Lonnie Donegan standing in.
Standing in for John. So they managed to make it to that wedding, but apparently they were terrible. And then towards the end of the year, a fire destroys Ringo's home, and he loses, in Hollywood, he loses a load of Beatles memorabilia, and he's still in the throes of addiction at this point.
Yes, I mean, at this point, you know, in the mid-70s, Ringo was hanging out with Harry Nilsson, with Keith Moon, Alice Cooper, Mickey Dolenz. They called themselves the Hollywood
Vampires. Yeah.
And he made the comment, we weren't musicians dabbling in drugs and alcohol, we were junkies dabbling in music.
Yeah, and I saw a clip recently of Ringo and Keith Moon being phenomenally drunk, and it's, you know, they're being funny and charming, but it's deeply sad, particularly yeah. as, you know, Keith Moon was only 32 when he died in 1978. So, you know, it's I think as the years go by, what seemed at the time to be incredible
yes,
hijinks,
amusing rock and roll behavior,
you now kind of look back and think, you know, Ringo has said he lost years of his life. He just didn't know what was going on. So by the time we get to the end of 79, Ringo is not in a good place commercially, critically, and in terms of his health. What's George up to?
George, again, George started off well in the 70s. You got All Things Must Pass, Concert for Bangladesh. The 74 tour of America is probably the downturn for him. He's got laryngitis. The tour is very badly received. Sort of a very infamous takedown in Rolling Stone. That he was always quite bitter about. So his commercial stock is on the slide. Extra Texture is not regarded well, doesn't sell well. But he had started to make a little bit of a comeback. He formed his own record label, signed up with Warner Brothers after a bit of a false start with A&M. A couple of hit singles in America in 76. This song, Crackerbock Palace, interestingly, not charting in the UK at all. Very much now focused on the US market. He's appearing on Saturday Night Live. Yep. He's appearing on Soul Train. So that period, sort of 76, is a little bit of an upward swing, but certainly nothing like the highlights of the early 70s. And his career sort of drifting slightly towards the end of the decade. 1979, he's got that eponymous album, George Harrison. Very commercial, poppy sound.
Yeah, he has a producer in.
Yeah, he's got Russ Titelman in, and the idea is clearly we're going to try and get him a hit in the American market. And I never really, you know, he had top 20 hit with the album, top 20 hit with the single Blow Away, but it just doesn't really click.
Yes.
And I think with hindsight, I think you can say that's really the beginning of his sort of retreat.
Yes.
He's less and less interested in the music business. He's got other interests. He's hanging out with Formula One racing drivers.
Well, the other big business interest in 79
is the Python. So he funds Life of Brian. That leads to the formation of Handmade Films eventually. So he's got other interests.
Yeah. And if you were to probably meet George Harrison at the end of 1979, he'd probably say he's happy. He's got a new son.
Yep.
He's in a stable marriage. You know, the fact that Blow Away doesn't become a mega hit single means, you know, it probably wouldn't have troubled him, because he didn't feel the desire or the need to do the legwork that McCartney did of interviews,
no.
promo, publicity,
no.
touring, any of that stuff.
You really get the sense that he doesn't have that ambition anymore. It's well known he is the one that right from the beginning of the 60s fell out of love with being a Beatle first.
Yes.
You know, he doesn't like being famous. He doesn't like being a rock star. He likes everything that comes with it. You know, he likes the money, the cars.
The other stuff.
But, you know, it's a hard life.
So then we get on to Paul McCartney. Do we really need to talk about Paul's 70s?
How long have we got?
There could be a podcast in themselves.
No, please.
No, all right, fair enough. But obviously, you know, the Wings build by the mid-70s is, you know, he's managed to get back on top with Band on the Run, Venus and Mars, Wings at the Speed of Sound, and the associated Wings Over the World tour. Towards the end of the 70s, though, you know, there's a bit of a retreat. James McCartney is born at the end of 1977, and that kind of curtails touring a little bit, because I think there were plans to tour before they realised that James was coming along. He put out the London Town, Wings put out the London Town album in 1978, and then in 78 they were down to a trio, so they re-expanded to a five-piece again for the last lineup of Wings, with Holly and Juber joining in on drums and guitar. They were two excellent session players, so that kind of last incarnation of Wings, which if we ever get a Back to the Egg reissue, yeah, we might talk about again. But that was a very strong version of Wings, and because they were session players, they were potentially there for the long term. Yep. There wasn't any plan that Wings were going anywhere. They were brought in as equal partners. Paul re-signed to Columbia Records in the US for 1979, so there was this big commercial push for his first album on Columbia in the US, which was Back to the Egg. And Back to the Egg, it just doesn't... He starts to kind of slip out of the culture for a bit. It doesn't have any breakthrough hit. Pick up any Paul McCartney album from the 70s, and if you're a very casual fan, you'll recognise a song or two.
Yeah.
I think if you're a casual Paul McCartney fan, you look at the back of Back to the Egg, there's not really going to be anything you recognise particularly.
No, I mean, the single from that lineup was Goodnight Tonight.
Yeah.
Which doesn't appear on the album.
Yeah.
And I think at this stage... with hindsight, McCartney doesn't talk particularly favourably about Back to the Egg. I mean, I personally, and I know you...
I love Back to the Egg.
I love Back to the Egg as well. I think it's one of his strongest solo albums. But he seems to sort of lose a little bit of confidence maybe at that stage. I think that's my take on it anyway.
Yes.
The interesting thing is that final tour, that final Wings UK tour, he's starting to reintroduce...
Well,
Beatles song.
That is the thing. So he does get back on the road. Mm. So, you know, he'd finished the mega, you know, proving himself world tour in 76. He had been, you know, he's not shy about getting back onto the road, and he eventually gets back on the road in the UK at the end of 79. And he's playing modest enough venues, but they're full houses. He's got a span of songs. He's playing, you know, things like Hot as Sun from the very first McCartney album. He's coming on stage and opening with Gotta Get You Into My Life with a horn section. You know, the band is ready to go for the next phase of touring in 1980, which we'll touch upon in a second. But, you know, he's got a new version of Wings. He's got a set list. He's got a new album. He's figuring out what's going on. And so he finishes the year playing the concerts for the people of Kampuchea.
Yeah.
And, you know, that gives you an idea of what a 1980s Paul McCartney tour would have looked like.
Yes. There are some very good bootlegs. I mean, I think those tours, some of those concerts were recorded. So as you say, if there's a box set for Back to the Egg, that's sort of what we're...
Yeah, and he also plays Glasgow on that tour where the live version of Coming Up is recorded.
Yes.
And that's in right at the end of 79 as well.
Yeah.
So he's just doing what he's doing, but Wings don't look like they're going anywhere.
No, I mean, Wings are still a functioning band, and this is the latest incarnation. And can we talk a little bit about the Kampuchea concert?
Yeah, sure.
I'm old enough to remember this being trailed, the build-up to this. So for people that don't know, it was a series of concerts in London across a number of days. So you had people like The Pretenders, you had The Queen, you had...
The Who.
Elvis
Costello and the
Elvis
Attractions.
Costello,
Rock Pile.
With Robert Plant.
With Robert Plant, up. Yeah.
So it was a series of concerts to raise money for, I suppose, the phrase is the boat people from Kampuchea. These are refugees fleeing from Cambodia / Kampuchea. And
I am old enough to remember. I don't remember the concerts. I remember Blue Peter having an appeal at the same time same charity.
This was something that the UN... I think Kurt Waldheim was the Secretary General, and he had earlier in the year he had been talking about if the Beatles could get back together, that would be great, and we could raise lots of money. And there was a sort of build up of pressure there, to the extent that there were sort of newspaper headlines saying the Beatles are getting back together again. They're going to be a concert. It's going to be a concert. In fact, what we had were these concerts in London. Graham Thompson, in his biography, Behind the Locked Door of George Harrison, says that George and Ringo were on board, not for a reunion, but to appear at the concert. Now, I've not read that anywhere else.
Yes.
Given, you know, I can see Ringo being prepared to step up and come on stage with Paul. I don't know about George and his state of mind at that time, but Thompson is very clear. But when the publicity started to be around the lines of it's the Beatles, he says they both sort of backtracked.
Yeah.
Lennon, I think, we talk a little bit about where Lennon was in the late 70s, but I don't think he was ever really on board. But I do recall, would either have been the NME or Melody Maker doing a little review of the various concerts, including the Wings, the final one, and being very scathing about the fact that, you know, we all were waiting for somebody to come on. But, you know, I think Billy Connolly was the compere, and he was teasing the audience by saying, oh, I don't want to get you excited, but I've just seen the Applejacks backstage. And but the NME, very critical, you know, at the end of the night, no sign of a, and I think they talk about, you know, a thin-lipped, pointy-nosed cattle farmer with his Japanese wife was a no-show. I mean, it's a very kind of scathing, mean take on that. But Lennon at that stage, I don't think he was in a place where he would have been interested.
But what Paul did have in his back pocket at the end of 79 was the McCartney 2 album, which he had recorded in August on his own, on a few, about a 3 week break from General Wings activity. And there'd been a clue at the end of 79 about what was coming, because Wonderful Christmas Time had made its debut, which is, you know, recorded as part of the McCartney 2 sessions. It comes out as a single not credited to Wings, but has Wings in the video. And so it's kind of seen as a kind of a standalone one-off novelty. And so it's not really known yet that he's got more of that kind of
in the can.
Yes, single, one-man band madness in the can. So for John Lennon, the end of 1979, people have just assumed that he's retired.
Yes, I mean, he's been off the scene really since 75, 76. He made a very public announcement in 1977 saying, that's it, we're just going to take some time to ourselves. That followed the birth of Sean Lennon in 1975. From that point on, he appears on Ringo's 1976 album, Rotogravure. Again, not a great album. There's a track, Cooking in the Kitchen of Love, which is a very kind of perfunctory Lennon song, just the kind of thing you imagine he might write and give away to Ringo. But that's his last appearance of the 70s in a recording studio. He's dabbled with bits and pieces. He famously also went through that kind of lost weekend period where he too is hanging out with Keith Moon, Harry Nilsson. He had the good sense to get back off, back away from that, and he sort of returns to domestic life with Yoko. The interesting thing is, just before he retreats, he's involved in three number one hit singles.
Yeah, and that's
in the States.
Forgotten about in a way.
So he sort of, in one sense, he exited on a high. His career had, after the sort of high points of Plastic Ono Band and Imagine, really his career...
A bit of a wobble,
to put it mildly. I mean, I'm very unimpressed by anything that... You know, there's one or two songs to pad out a greatest hits, but sometime in New York City, Mind Games is weak, Walls and Bridges, he talks about that as being kind of hack work. But whatever gets you through the night...
Number one
single, featuring Elton John.
Yeah,
that leads to him appearing on stage Thanksgiving with Elton John. They do Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which Elton John has, I think, just released.
Same week.
Number one single.
With John on guitar.
With he had this little reggae section in the middle, and that's Lennon doing that. The B-side of that is a cover of One Day at a Time, and I think Lennon plays on that as well. Third number one, David Bowie, Fame, which is a co-write. So he's involved in three US number one singles and then just buys out.
And they're kind of, I mean, you could argue Elton John and David Bowie are trying to ride in the slipstream of John Lennon and the Beatle, or it could look the other way, that these are guys, you know,
helping out kind of
An old legend.
I think so. I mean, that kind of helping out an old legend.
Like the Smiths and Sandy Shaw. Or
the Pet Shop Boys and Dusty Springfield.
Yes, that's
John
exactly
Lennon
what it's
is
like.
Is Dusty Springfield to David Bowie's
Pet
Shop Boys.
I've been saying it for years, yes. but he does have this marked withdrawal. But, you know, at the end of 79, he meets Ringo. He gives him a song, Life Begins at 40, for whatever Ringo's about to do next. And then, generally speaking... something you pointed out to me is that across Christmas 1979, the BBC show a load of Beatle films.
Yes. So I don't know whether that links into the sort of pre-concert for Campuchia, kind of, there's a reunion, and there was a little bit of an interest in the Beatles, and I suppose you're coming up to the anniversary of years.
It's an end of a decade.
It's the end of a decade. Yeah. The 60s, very much the Beatles' decade. The 70s had been something else entirely. But there's a little bit of nostalgia coming in. But yeah, they show all of the films plus Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
Gets an airing.
So at the end of 1979, as it turns into 1980, that is the state of affairs. So let's get into 1980 and have a walk through that. The first big thing that's supposed to happen in 1980 is that Paul is due to go and play some gigs in Japan. And the plan had been that Wings would tour Japan, and there was rough plans in place that there would be a Wings tour probably of North America later that same year. And then maybe by the end of the year, back to Europe for another round. And so the plan was to play 11 concerts in Japan. Over 100,000 tickets had been sold. The concerts were due to start on the 21st of January 1980 and end on the 2nd of February 1980 across five venues in three cities, and ending in the Budokan, Tokyo, where the Beatles had played just 13 and a half years earlier. And so at the start of the year, before they fly out on the 16th of January, Paul calls the Dakota on the 12th of January.
Yeah, so Paul and Linda have and the kids have flown to New York, and Paul calls Dakota to speak to John.
And then what happens?
Yoko intercepts the call.
This is going to be a recurring theme.
This is going to be a recurring theme. So my understanding is that prior to this, Paul had last spoken to John in around 1976, which is around the time of the Saturday Night Live spoof, Let's Get the Beatles Back Together Again. So Yoko intercepts the call. Paul tells her, you know, I'm on my way to Japan, and I have some quote unquote dynamite weed. he wants to come over, and Yoko basically is saying it's not happening.
Yep.
He doesn't get to speak to John, but before the call ends, he tells Yoko that they're going to Tokyo and they're staying in the Okura Hotel. Mm-hmm. I don't know anything about this hotel except that it was John and Yoko's favorite hotel.
Yeah, and John and Yoko had done traveling in the late 70s, and they'd been to Japan.
They did.
John had played piano in a hotel bar in Japan.
Yeah, so they had stayed in this hotel at least four times. Now there is, I'm not sure if there's a story about the room that they stay in had its own private elevator.
Yeah,
and some couple, elderly couple, get into this lift by mistake, go up accidentally to the floor, the door opens, and John is sitting playing the guitar.
Right.
So they're saying these are the last people to see John Lennon playing a kind of impromptu concert. But anyway, they're Yoko reportedly, I mean, the rumor is, you know, Yoko not happy
about
that,
this.
Yeah, that the good vibes of this hotel are going to be spoiled by Paul and Linda.
So then that leads to, that's the 12th of January, the 16th of January, Paul and the whole entourage, the family and Wings, they arrive in Tokyo. And when they get to customs, they find some quote-unquote dynamite weed.
A full 8 ounces of dynamite weed.
A full half pound of butter full of weed in Paul's suitcase. And, you know, in later years, he might have been a bit more lighthearted about it, but he describes that they just opened the bag and it's just sitting there.
Yeah, there appears to have been no attempt to hide this, sort of, you know, wrap it up in a sock or something. I mean, it's just sitting on the top of the suitcase.
Is that how to do this? Yes. So he gets arrested immediately, and because he has this large block of drugs in his bag, and apparently, looking back at the time, the stories of the time say it had roughly a £5,000 street value.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah. I don't know how true that is, which would be about 30,000 euros in today's money of dynamite weed in his bag.
And his immediate defence is it was for my own personal consumption,
yeah.
All 30,000 pounds worth of the dynamite weed.
Quite possible, knowing how bleary-eyed he was at
yes,
the time.
In the 70s, that's entirely possible.
But he is arrested and he's put in jail where he spends the next 8 nights, isn't it?
Yeah.
And immediately the tour is cancelled. 100,000 tickets gone, and you know, there are rumours that develop after time that somehow Yoko is involved in this arrest.
Yes.
And I think they are just rumours.
They are just rumours.
They're probably fed on the anti-Yoko sentiment that permeates our culture unfairly.
Paul has been very quick to say he doesn't believe any of that. But
yes,
one thing: this is the first time that Paul McCartney has been behind bars since 1960.
Oh, yes.
In Hamburg, when they allegedly set fire to the Bambi Kino.
By lighting a condom.
By lighting a condom.
That's
on the wall.
It's quite a rap sheet he's got.
So you know, you've got the John Eastman, his brother-in-law, is flying to Tokyo. There's a whole sort of
diplomatic
incident here because, you know, the British consul is involved. This is a top news story. This is going on for several days.
Yes.
The story is Paul McCartney faces 7 years in a Japanese prison. They're looking, clearly the authorities are looking for some way to defuse this. And they're saying, well, he hadn't passed through customs. So maybe we could raise the argument that, you know, he hadn't quite landed, or we could just deport him.
Yep.
And there's a lot of sort of frantic behind the scenes activity. One thing is, there was a death as a result of this.
Oh.
There was a fan called Kenneth Lambert. And Kenneth Lambert was shot dead by police at Miami Airport when he turned up with a gun trying to get on a plane to go and rescue Paul in Tokyo.
My goodness.
So this is a kind of, you know, the craziness that of the Beatle years still kind of hanging around.
There is bad mojo in the air.
There is bad mojo kicking around.
Okay. And so, 16th, he's arrested. He's there for 8 days. There's a big unknown quantity about, you know, what's going to happen to him. Is he staying? Is he going? What deal is going to be cut? After 5 days, Wings leave.
Yeah.
The other members of Wings leave. Denny Lane heads to the south of France and does a deal for a solo record, which, you know, kind of comes back to destroy the relationship.
Yeah, Paul extremely unhappy about this.
And 5 days into incarceration, there's a telegram of support, isn't there?
Yeah, from George, Olivia and Danny.
It's great that's what it takes for George to give Paul a thumbs up.
Well, now you've had your 5 nights in jail.
Now that you're in prison.
Yeah.
I'm happy to
be your mate.
That makes me smile. Famously, George or Paul says that you know, these were the first nights he had ever spent apart from Linda since 1969.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, he talks about it in the Wingspan documentary in whatever that was, 2001, where he, in his Paul manner, casts a rosy glow on, well, you know, I tried to get on with the other prisoners and I tried to sing songs and we had jokes, but I didn't really know what was happening on the outside. And he writes a book.
He does.
Doesn't he? Or is it in prison or when he comes out of prison?
When he comes out of prison, he kind of commits this to writing with his sort of a diary, which is called Japanese Jailbird.
There you go.
You know, a little subtle.
But he's never released it, but he's apparently locked it in a vault.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing that sometime.
In 50 years' time.
In 50 years'
when
time.
When he is unwell.
In terms of sort of the rumours, there's Howie Casey, who is a musician that was sort of goes all the way back to sort of
Liverpool.
He's the musician that said, don't bring the Beatles to Hamburg. They're a terrible band. They're no good. But he was actually touring as part of the horn section in Wings. And his take on this is that Paul was taking the rap for Linda.
Yes.
That this was actually, that Linda was the one who was sort of most devoted to the dynamite weed, even more so than Paul, and that it was her suitcase and that it was, she had just slipped this into the suitcase.
Yes.
And that's his take on it. Steve Holly.
Yeah.
His take is that he thinks that possibly consciously or subconsciously, Paul wanted to scupper the tour.
Yeah.
That he hadn't been particularly enamored with the live band and the live performances, mm-hmm. and was really kind of growing tired of the Wings, the band setup.
Yeah.
And I suppose that might, at least the growing tired aspect might tie in with the McCartney 2 having been recorded.
But there's also the notion that Paul just didn't get stopped at customs.
Yeah.
You know, he's Paul McCartney.
Well, this was Ringo's take, was sort of, you know, you've got to be careful, and it was stupid. I mean, he's much less sympathetic. He's just saying, well, it was a stupid thing to do.
Yes.
And the other little interesting footnote is that normally you would have insurance, tour insurance against, you know, all of these various cancellations. Only due to an administrative oversight, the insurance had lapsed.
Right.
So this was completely absent, and all those ticket cancellations
had to be paid for
otherwise than through insurance. So.
And so that one incident of having the weed, getting arrested, means that Wings will never play live again.
Yeah.
So there's never another Wings concert after that. And as we said, Denny Lane, who'd been the stalwart in Wings since 1971, goes off and cuts a deal for a solo record and reacts on that a little later in the year.
I think that was really the final straw for Denny Lane. Because what you have
but to Denny still stays in the picture.
He's they're still there. And I mean, Wings are still kind of floating around in the background. Yeah. But what you have to remember is Denny Lane, Holly Juber, they're not getting money from songwriting.
No.
So it's the live work is what's, and I think it's Lane and Steve Holly go off and do a little mini tour in the UK of their own, play a few gigs just to get some money. Well, you think this is a hugely successful rock band, and the guitarist and the drummer are going to have to go out and play some gigs just to get some.
As a side point, you know, the year we're recording this, 2019, there have been some gigs this year where Lane, Holly and Juber from that last lineup of Wings have been playing Back to the Eggs material at fan conventions.
Yeah, the Chicago Beatles Fest.
And it looks fantastic. I think a tour of that, it's a wonder a Wings tour from, you know, everybody who used to be near a band is touring in some capacity, that there hasn't been an ex-Wings tour of.
I thought you were going to say we should go on.
go to the Chicago Beatles Fest.
Chicago Beatles Fest next year.
We'll see if nothing is real budget, we'll stretch to that. So that takes up an awful lot of January. And so Paul is back in the UK, deported from Japan at the end of the month. And he does make an appearance at the end of the month on This Is Your Life for George Martin.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether that was recorded before the arrest or after the arrest.
No, I think that was after.
A live thing.
That was a live
thing. That was his first.
Yep, his reappearance. And the other interesting aspect there is they asked George Harrison to do it and he said no.
Oh, okay.
He was going on holiday.
That's George.
Not even a filmed insert. So,
and again, he's here tonight.
And he's here tonight.
It wasn't even one of those.
Not even one of those.
And actually, Paul had been on, there's a great footage, another sidebar of Paul and Wings on This Is Your Life years earlier. I think it's John Conte's This Is Your Life.
Yeah.
And they're in Abbey Road, and it's a filmed insert from Abbey Road that he does for This Is Your Life.
Well, George is prepared to turn up for Racing Drivers and things like that on their This Is Your Life, but not for George Martin.
There you go. That's priorities for you. So a very busy January. So even January alone is enough to turn the world of Wings on its head. In February, Ringo starts production on his latest movie, called Caveman, which, you know, I always threaten someday we will do a podcast called The Films of Ringo Starr, and Caveman will play a part of that. I've tried to watch sections of Caveman.
I've never seen any of it.
It's an open, largest set of inverted commas in the ever comedy, close, largest inverted commas in the world ever. But it is important for one issue, which is he meets Barbara Bach on set. And, you know, Barbara goes on to be his wife, and they are still happily married to this day. It's an odd film, and it's...
No dialogue.
It's got very little dialogue, and it's set in prehistoric times, and all sorts of capers happen.
Dennis Quaid in that?
Possibly. It's been a while.
I think Dennis Quaid, possibly also not a good influence, Ringo and Dennis Quaid hanging out together.
Right, yes. Yeah. Yes, well, he's still, you know, we'll come back to this again later on. Ringo and Barbara are both, you know,
fond of a drink.
Yes, they are alcoholics and have addiction issues at this point in time. So then as the year progresses in March, I think March is when George starts to work in his own Friar Park Studios on his next solo album.
Yeah, so he's still contracted to Warner Brothers, has another album to deliver, and he starts the sessions for that next album.
Yeah,
Sort of fairly sporadically, he'll work on that over the next year, effectively.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, George's estate where he lived, Friar Park, you know, beautiful, whenever we see it in any of the George documentaries, it's a beautiful part of the world. And to have his own studios, that it's tantalising to think about what is hanging around in the Friar Park archives.
Yes. I mean, I think by all accounts, it's a very extensive archive.
Yeah.
And frustratingly little, I think, has emerged.
Well, another side point, Early Takes Volume 1 is possibly my favourite George Harrison album, On Certain Days.
Yes, it's a fantastic album. It's that stripped back takes on those sort of slightly overproduced All Things Must Pass.
Yeah.
Just amazing. Yeah.
Well, anyway, apparently there is an archivist in FP shot going through the George Harrison archive. So maybe in the next couple of years, if we get to the 50th anniversary next year of All Things Must Pass.
It is. And I mean, he's working with the usual kind of crew of musicians. So he's got Ray Cooper. These are the people he regularly works with.
That
all kind of live in the same area. There's this kind of Henley-on-Thames mafia, so there's like members of Traffic and Joe Brown and these people, Ray Cooper, are all kind of just, it's very different from the way McCartney's been working with Wings.
And another thing that happens in March that you pointed out is that there's an auction in Sotheby's.
Yeah, this is a really, it's a pop memorabilia auction, 3rd of March in London, and it's really the first or one of the first of its kind. And there's a few little items cropping up there, Beatles related items, and you think this is the start.
Yes.
10 years on, this is the start of that whole sort of industry.
Yes.
of memorabilia, everything that they've worn, that they've touched.
Yeah, that whole Hard Rock Cafe kind of thing.
is starting to emerge there.
And it's interesting because I certainly remember being a music fan in the 80s that these very much became a thing, you know, and they'd appear on the news. There's another rock and roll memorabilia auction. I remember it kind of culminated in Elton John. Do you remember this?
His entire wardrobe.
He basically sold off his entire house full of archival material about 1988, and it was a big kind of 3 or 4 day Sotheby's thing. So this definitely becomes a thing. And there's actually a few years later in 83-84, the host of Saturday Night Live is none other than Ringo Starr. Mm-hmm. And we might talk more about Saturday Night Live someday, but the opening sketch on the show is set in an auction house, and the next lot to be wheeled on is Ringo Starr, and we're going to auction this genuine piece of Beatles memorabilia.
And no one bids? Is that the...
That could be the joke, yes. Yeah.
It's with Martin Short. It's hard to find the joke.
Yeah, that's right, actually.
Martin, he's the auctioneer.
That's right, he is
so
the auctioneer.
So it's probably not a very funny
Martin
sketch.
Short, who has done sketches with 50% of the Beatles.
Yeah. None of them funny.
We love Martin Short. I love
we
Martin
don't
Short.
Love Martin
this
Short.
This is one of the things that myself and Stephen disagree with on quite viciously. Anyway, let's... so that's March. And at the end of March, the Rarities LP comes out in the US.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting because we talked in the compilations episode that there's lots of repackaging going on in the late 70s, early 80s. And Rarities is something that perhaps should have been more important than another Love Songs compilation.
It's a peculiar album because there are two albums. There's a US version and there's a UK version.
Yeah.
So whenever they boxed up all of the official releases, they put in this EMI in the UK, added Rarities. So it had things like the German version of I Want to Hold Your Hand, mm-hmm. and She Loves You, and various different takes, things like that. And they were absolutely adamant, this is only ever going to be available in this box set. You must shell out for this box set. And then once the box set had sold out, then they thought, well, we'll just release this.
So that's where they learned to do that thing they've been doing ever since.
In America, of course, what was appearing on the UK Rarities was comprised of quite a few American-only mixes. So that wouldn't have worked in America as a Rarities album. So they then produced this. And it is actually very interesting. And if you do, I would recommend people go out and try and find it. So you've got slightly different take, different edit of Penny Lane. You've got a different edit of I Am the Walrus.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, they also make an entire track out of the final run-out groove of Sgt. Pepper, which never appeared on the Sgt. Pepper.
No, I didn't know that till a couple of years ago.
So they actually think, well, we can squeeze another track out of that. So they just put that little piece of gibberish.
That's the best bit of Sgt. Pepper.
It is. It's the highlight.
But it's interesting because, you know, you talk about this kind of commodification of rock and roll that they're trying to, you know, there's the rock and roll memorabilia auctions. You know, we're starting to look at how do you repackage this material?
Yeah.
How do you repackage the stuff that's not the original stuff?
Exactly.
And it's all a bit amateurish because it's uncharted territory. But again, it's uncharted territory that has the Beatles' name on it, which is what they were best at. So then we go into April 1980. And on the 11th of April 1980, the best thing happens ever, which is the release of Coming Up by Paul McCartney. And I've spoken about being a Paul fan.
Really?
I think I might have mentioned that before.
You hide that well. It doesn't come across.
But I certainly think Coming Up is a phenomenal achievement. And I'm talking about the studio version.
Yeah.
And it's a single I love very much. And I probably have a personal connection to it because even though I was a small child at the time, it's the first time I saw Paul McCartney. I saw the video on Kenny Everett's video show.
Yeah.
And I went back and looked.
Your parents were allowing you to watch the Kenny Everett show.
Yeah, I know. And that's a low bar. So I would have been
too late to call social services.
That was on the Kenny Everett video show on the 14th of April 1980.
I was probably watching that too.
So we were probably watching that together. And I remember thinking, you know, this is a fantastic thing. I was too young to realize that I needed to go and buy it or to what was going on. And it was only when I saw it again a few years later.
This is the video where Paul appears, multiple versions of himself.
Yes. And it's
the Plastic Max.
The Plastic Max. And he's dressed as Ron Mayall from Sparks. And he's dressed as Neil Young and Buddy Holly. And he's dressed as Beatle Paul. And it's a technologically quite sophisticated video.
For the time, yeah. And is that a nod
to the Plastic
Ono Band?
I
wondered.
I would think that if you're us, you would say yes. But if you're Paul, you would say, what?
Yeah.
You know, because they don't seem to think about this stuff as much as we do. But, you know, Coming Up is a great single. And it's one of these songs, I think, that, you know, I personally think it's great because it's a great recording. It's a great record.
It's a great record.
It's kind of flimsy almost in terms of the actual songwriting.
Yeah.
Although we can come back to that in a sec. But, you know, it's the actual recording where Paul is playing almost everything himself.
It is. These kind of keyboards and that very modern sound for 1980. And it's like nothing he has done before.
No. And it's under the Paul McCartney banner. It's not under the Wings banner. Although, in the US, it seemed as a little too far out there. And so a live version by Wings is put on the B-side.
Yeah.
And that gets flipped over to be the A-side in the US. And that becomes number one.
And it
can be, you know, I've noticed on message boards and things, you can find out where somebody's from by asking them what version of Coming Up do they like. You know, the live version or the studio version. But it's literally the crossroads song where, you know, it's like a metaphor. Wings are on one side.
Yeah.
This is how Wings would do it. Paul's on the other side saying, well, this is how Paul would do it. And
which do you prefer?
You can decide which one you prefer. But it's a sensational song. And there's a great cover version by the lead singer of Hot Chip, who put it out a few years ago, and I'm embarrassed now because his name has just escaped my brain. But it's well worth checking out, where he slows it right down, plays it very acoustically, very straight, and actually you think,
in the style of a John Lewis ad.
Oh, now you've ruined it. But that video that Alexis Taylor, that's his name, very nice. And, you know, Hot Chip also plug into, they're big McCartney 2 fans because they're the people who take another McCartney 2 track, Temporary Secretary, and put it into DJ sets. But that video, as I said, is on the Kenny Everett show on the 14th of April 1980. And the video is also seen on Saturday Night Live on the 17th of May 1980. And you have to wonder, maybe Lennon saw that video? We know he heard the song
in
a car.
We know he heard the song. His personal assistant, Fred Seaman, who, you know, take everything he says with a pinch of salt if you've read any of his books. But he says that John heard the song on the radio for the first time on the 13th of April, which would have been 2 days after it was released.
Okay.
And certainly Lennon talks about, you know, this is a good piece of work, is how he describes it.
Yes.
And I know you and I had that discussion about where I was saying, oh, well, maybe he heard the live version.
But he didn't hear the live version.
It was the studio version that he was particularly
And he explicitly said he loves that crazy studio version. Yeah. And so he hears that song, and he still might have heard it, seen it again a few weeks later on Saturday Night Live. We don't know for sure, but, you know, it's possible. And the thing I've wondered is, you know, did what happened, you know, Coming Up was a massive hit, and it is a great song, but did the publicity from January, after coming off the back end of a very sort of beige 1979 Back to the Egg, did the publicity in January put Paul McCartney back in the public consciousness, and people were like, they might have thought, oh, this is the song, that this is his inspiration post-Japan, even though it was recorded before Japan?
Well, I mean, I think that old chestnut about, you know, no such thing as bad publicity, you know, it's kind of maybe suddenly McCartney's a little bit edgy.
Yeah.
You know, Wings, 1976, were a kind of hard rocking band.
Yeah.
Wings Over America, you know, very kind of, it's a rock album.
Yes.
Then suddenly you've got 1978, you've got London Town, a lot of keyboards. That's a kind of mishmash of styles, but the big hits are With a Little Luck.
Yep.
London Town, Mull of Kintyre is end of 77. So that Wings have really become desperately uncool.
Yes.
And I mean, I remember buying London Town and being mocked mercilessly by everybody in my class at school for liking Paul McCartney and Wings. So they were deeply, deeply uncool. The kind of change, the harder edge of Back to the Egg really hadn't reversed that or turned things around critically or commercially. So I think, yeah, you know, I suspect that publicity probably did him no harm.
Yeah. And so Lennon hears this song, and, you know, there's a lot of other songs in the ether. I'm kind of looking at, you know, stuff that was out at the time, but, you know, like at the start of that year, you have hits on the radio like Refugee by Tom Petty, Billy Joel's Glass Houses comes out in March, Pete Townsend's Empty Glass is a big hit album in that springtime as well, Crazy Little Thing Called Love. These are all big hits that are on the radio. We know John was also listening to Kate Bush and a few other people.
Yeah, he's maybe not producing records, but he's listening.
He is listening, he's reading about people, he's getting his
Sparks,
assistant.
Big fan of Sparks.
Well, who isn't? And, you know, and he's listening to Paul, and he's getting his assistant to pull these records. So his antenna is definitely up at this point in 1980. And all of these things eventually come to a head for him. But we are going to talk about those in the second part of our podcast on 1980, because it is such a huge year. We need to break this into two episodes. So join us again on the next time. We're going to talk about the rest of 1980. Please stay in touch with us in the usual places, on Twitter at Beatles Pod. Join the Facebook group. Look for Nothing Is Real on Facebook. And please leave a nice review with whatever podcast app or platform that you're listening to us on. But for the moment, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And join us again next time for the rest of 1980. Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.